Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Worldviews. Today, we're joined by Emerson Green. He's a philosopher, podcaster, and creator of Counterapologetics and Walden Pod. Emerson explores consciousness, religion, and the nature of reality, offering a balanced look at both atheism and theism. Emerson, thanks for coming on, man.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Yeah, can you just give the audience a quick glimpse to your upbringing?
Yeah, I had a good upbringing. It was a happy childhood. I was like an evangelical Christian in the Midwest, and I didn't like school. You know, I disliked being told what I would think about every moment of the day and these like arbitrary rules that are really strictly enforced and like memorizing and regurgitating things that you forget a week later. But my main preoccupation, I guess, was like playing instruments and stuff, which I used at church. Like I played at church and at different like church functions, like multiple times a week. And I was always interested in philosophical questions, you know, like epistemology, but I had no reference point for that. And no one I knew cared about philosophy or knew what it was. And I didn't know what philosophers were up to until I was an adult. So I didn't really come to this until later.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess what were the initial draws to, you know, really getting into consciousness, philosophy of the mind, and what kept you, I guess, so grounded in doing that for the time being?
Well, my intro to philosophy was apologetics. Like I went to an apologetics camp thing for a couple weeks and, you know, that was really fun. And I was enamored with philosophy like immediately. But with consciousness, it really is just the hard problem. Like the hard problem of consciousness is, I guess, the answer to what brought me in and what kind of keeps me. Like when I was a teenager, I was really into Sam Harris's podcast, and he talks about consciousness all the time. And, you know, he thinks it's one of the central mysteries of human existence. And I, you know, I generally liked what he had to say about it. And he pointed me to people like Thomas Nagel and David Chalmers. And the first philosophy book I owned was Mortal Questions by Thomas Nagel. And, you know, I guess one thing that keeps me thinking about it is that I don't think fitting consciousness with the physical world is going to be like disconnected from other things in philosophy. Like Thomas Nagel said in Mind and Cosmos, he opens up the book this way that the mind-body problem is not a local problem. You know, it's going to invade our understanding of the entire cosmos and its history. You know, you can't sort of vacuum seal off the mind-body problem and think like, oh, we'll just figure out how the brain and the mind interact and then that'll be that. It does invade our entire understanding of everything else. And there's just no obviously right answer to the mind-body problem, like especially once you take into account Nagel's point. I mean, a lot of materialists and substance dualists think it's pretty straightforward, but I think the problem is fairly intractable. That's how it seems to me. Like every time I think I have a satisfying answer, you find a bunch of problems with the view, and weighing all the trade-offs is hard. So that's how I've been stuck here for so long.
Yeah, because I imagine, because it's almost like, does a satisfying answer even exist, or can it exist? Or do you think that's something that can be solved only with time? Or do you think it's just one of those things that might be unsolvable for the long run?
I don't know if it's solvable in the sense that there will be like a definitive answer or some like really conclusive piece of evidence that we can all appreciate and say, well, there it is. Because, you know, Philip Goff likes to point out that consciousness is unobservable. Like, I think consciousness is kind of a private phenomenon. It's not something that's like publicly observable the way that brain activity is publicly observable. So that's like a huge wrench in the gears. Like that makes it way harder to come to an answer. Like it leaves everything open to interpretation if like the target phenomenon is not publicly observable. So, you know, there's always going to be an open door. And plus, like a lot of this is going to come down to, well, this consideration doesn't really bother me, and this consideration seems really persuasive to me. And, you know, that's going to be kind of subjective. So I think humans are going to be arguing about this until the end of time, even if we all kind of come to an answer and, you know, generally there's a consensus, we're never going to be totally sure.
Yeah, yeah. And also with your upbringing too, I wanted to understand, was there a particular moment that shifted you away from theism, or was it kind of a gradual process?
I mean, I guess it was a gradual process, but I do remember the exact moment that I realized I was an atheist. I don't know if I actually became an atheist then, or if I just realized that that's what I believed. But it was after that 2-week apologetics conference that I mentioned I went to when I was 19, I think, 18 or 19. And there wasn't any, well, I mean, there wasn't any one thing, but if I had to pick one, it would probably be eternal conscious torment, because it was all very like Christian centric at the time. You know, like I don't think I was really considering theism more broadly. I thought it was like, you know, Christianity is like the only serious version of theism, and like I wasn't really thinking about anything else. And I knew that Christianity, or, you know, the narrow version of Christianity that I'd been led to believe was like the sole legitimate form. I knew that that was false, and that story involved eternal conscious torment and, you know, penal substitution and literalism and inerrantism and the traditional view of the Trinity. And, yeah, in hindsight, a surprising amount of it, you know, stemmed from eternal conscious torment, maybe most of it, because I think that just kind of implodes the Christian worldview. Like, I can't believe it's taken seriously at all, but it, like more generally with theism and not just like a specific form of Christianity, I realized that like my central issue with theism was the evidence of evil and suffering, particularly that of animals in evolutionary history. And, if people want to read more about that, I think Quentin Smith and Felipe Leon and Paul Draper have kind of elucidated the core of the problem for me. And I think Joe Schmid, Majesty of Reason, like capably explains the issue. Like if he became a theist, that would trouble me a lot, because I think he actually understands the nature of the problem, like more than any theist I can think of. So that would really bother me. But yeah, it's the reason I'm not a theist is the problem of evil. But when I initially deconverted, I was like very focused on Christianity and, you know, a very narrow version of Christianity that's like fairly recent in history, but it was a lot simpler back then.
Sure. And did you also come to, I guess, would you say from your purview, Jesus was just a regular prophet or just a regular, I guess, teacher? And that was it?
Like what did I think of Jesus at the time?
I guess, what do you think now in terms of Jesus? Do you sit in the camp of he didn't exist? Do you think he was just a kind of, some people think he's a doomsday prophet, just a wise teacher?
He definitely existed. I mean, it seems like that, I mean, mythicism or whatever it's called is like a fringe view. I mean, Jesus is a pretty well-supported historical figure. Like we have firsthand written letters from someone who knew Jesus's brother, you know, like we have pretty decent evidence that Jesus existed. Like I've never really flirted with that idea, but the idea that he was an apocalyptic preacher, I mean, I'm not really qualified or well-read enough to like say that with any confidence, but when I do read about that, it does seem pretty convincing. Which is not to say he wasn't like a wise teacher. Like I reject like the C.S. Lewis trilemma thing, like, oh, you can't say he's just like a wise and interesting teacher. You know, he's a lunatic if he's not actually God. Like, I don't believe that's true. But yeah, I think he's like, I don't know, as I get older, I find him like more interesting and like his teaching, like his ethical teachings more revolutionary. And yeah, I'm interested in Jesus like as a historical figure and as like an ethical figure. You know, I was initially exposed to this idea that like Christianity is responsible for all of our modern moral sentiments, you know, by people who made their case very poorly, and it always just kind of annoyed me when I heard that. But I think I'm coming around to like a, you know, a more reasonable version of that view, that like, you know, Christianity obviously shaped the conscience of people in the West like a lot. And you know, so I guess I'm interested in him for that reason. Yeah, but I don't know. Some atheists and agnostics don't seem to find Jesus that impressive or interesting, but I definitely do find him interesting and impressive in lots of ways, even though I don't think he was God. I'm not even sure he claimed to be God, but yeah, I do think he's a fascinating figure.
Sure.
How could you not?
Yeah, I agree. He's very fascinating. And I'd like to hear about, because, you know, I think it gets quite ignored when people go from, let's say, Christianity to not Christian, or not Christian to Christian, whatever it is, whatever worldview shift you have. How was it for you going from Christianity to atheism in terms of existentialism, I guess, in that way? Like, was it dreading, or was it something that you were scared to do at first, but then embraced further on? Or how was that whole experience?
Yeah, I mean, it was horrible at first. Like, I kind of bought into what is a total lie, which is that, like, if you're an atheist, you have to be a nihilist or something like that. But I mean, I was so convinced that Christianity wasn't true that I just kind of bit the bullet on that for like 2 weeks, I guess. And, you know, and then I snapped out of it. But yeah, it was really hard because I took my faith really seriously and it was, you know, like a core part of my life. And yeah, it was not easy. Like, I remember hearing one atheist say that when he deconverted, it was like a friend died or something, you know, because you have this relationship with Jesus and then all of a sudden that's gone. So yeah, it was not an easy transition, but then I kind of embraced it and it was fine. You know, I mean, it was, you know, I read like existentialists and for, you know, this is like when I'm like 20 or 21 and like that really kind of helped, I guess. And then now all that stuff seems so overdramatic to me and like overwrought of just like shaking your fist at the universe and like, you know, like the Camus stuff and all that. It's just like, man, just get on with your life. Like, I don't know why, it just seems like melodramatic to me now, but at the time it was like really meaningful. But yeah, it was a rough transition. And then I kind of found some almost like quasi religious texts that helped me a lot. And then I don't know, you just kind of calm down and it's just not that big of a deal. It's like, but yeah, now it's not hard at all. I mean, I would still like theism to be true, obviously, but, it's not like this big gut wrenching thing like it was.
But okay. So would you want Christianity to be true or just theism to be true?
I mean, I guess that depends on what kind of Christianity we're talking about. Like, if we're talking about, you know, David Bentley Hart's Christianity, then that would be great. Or like Mormonism, that would be great. But if we're talking about like the majority of people are going to just be annihilated or like, you know, tormented for all of time because they failed a theology test, it's like, well, that would be horrible. But that's also incompatible with theism. So I'm not really worried about it. You know, certain forms of Christianity are like internally incoherent, I think. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess the way that I think about God is through the lens of Christianity, and I can't really help that. So, you know, I don't think I would just be atheist. Like, I think I would kind of, if I did become convinced of theism, I would probably just join some tradition, even though I didn't agree with all of it, and, you know, try to learn from the other people in it. It's tempting to do that even when you don't believe, but yeah, I don't know. Even if I was some kind of generic theist, I probably would join some kind of tradition for like pragmatic reasons. But yeah, I mean, I guess I do hope Christianity is true, if by Christianity we mean the idea that I have in my head and not other people's idea of Christianity.
Yeah, yeah. I always think that's so fascinating because I think us religious folk always assume that if someone was atheist and agnostic, started to believe in God, that all of a sudden assumes it's the God that we subscribe to. That can almost be any God, really, or even just a deistic form of God. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's interesting. Because I imagine, too, when you probably watched a lot of debates, like apologetic debates, too.
I used to, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Did you have like favorite apologists that you were really into?
Are we talking like 10 years ago or now?
Yeah. I mean, unless you watch any now just for the sake of fun.
I don't really like anybody now. I mean, in terms of like who's defending my side, it's like, I don't know. I have a bunch of eclectic views and like there's no one really prominent who's like defending my overall view. But back in the day, I did really like the New Atheist because that kind of is what I thought, you know. I really, like I mentioned earlier, I did really like Sam Harris, but yeah. Eventually you kind of, at least for me, I kind of outgrew some of that. And yeah, I don't know. I don't really root for anybody anymore. There's no one who's like representing my point of view and I don't really care. There's no one who I'm like rooting for or cheering for on the sidelines.
Yeah, because I imagine too, do people reach out to you for debates and conversations over these kind of things, these kind of issues?
Not really. I'm not very good at debates. Like I've done a few of them and I'm just always very nervous and just like read off of my notes and don't Like, I'm not a very good debater, but yeah, I mean, occasionally I do debates and sometimes people reach out. I can't remember ever saying no. I mean, I probably did once or twice, just because some people are such bad faith actors and they're just idiots and they don't realize it. There's a lot of that, like on the atheist YouTube side of things. I just don't want to engage with them. But yeah, I mean, I'm open to debating. I usually say yes, I think, but it's been a year or two since someone asked me.
Okay. And I want to talk a little bit more about the whole panpsychism stuff, because I always think that's interesting. So correct me if I'm wrong, but panpsychism basically means that consciousness itself is a prerequisite of reality?
You could put it that way, yeah.
Okay. And you'd say you're pretty loyal to this view?
Yeah, I think it's plausible. I mean, I think it's my favorite view. The way that I divide up my credences is like, I think that panpsychism is plausible. I think that substance dualism is plausible. I think Mysterianism is plausible. And then I try to leave space for something I haven't thought of, or, you know, just a new, because I've changed my mind so many times. It's dumb to really like put my foot down somewhere. But I do think panpsychism has a lot of advantages and not a lot of downsides. And yeah, I think dualism, most people are too quick to dismiss it. But yeah, I don't know if I believe panpsychism. I mean, I think like most days, I think it's like the most plausible option, but that doesn't mean I think it's like more probably true than not. I just think it's like the best option of a bad lot.
Yeah. What do you think people are most to misunderstand about the panpsychist view?
Well, I mean, some people seem to think that, I mean, two things come to mind. One is just the nature of the view. They think that it means everything is conscious. Like, you know, the books on your shelf have a mind and they're thinking like, I'm a book. This sucks. I just sit here like on the shelf. And that's not the view at all. I mean, the view is just roughly that the intrinsic nature of matter is consciousness. So like the way panpsychists view you is that you have a body and a brain, and the intrinsic nature of that brain and body is consciousness, like your inner life. That just sort of is the concrete nature of this physical stuff. It sort of fills out the structure that's observable, you know, by third personal means. But that doesn't mean that everything has, like, everything you can name has a point of view. It just means that there's only consciousness. Yeah, so panpsychism doesn't mean everything is conscious, even though the etymology there is like pan meaning all and psychism meaning, you know, consciousness or soul or something. And the other thing people misunderstand, I think, is like the motivation for panpsychism. They think that, because I hear panpsychists say like, well, you can't just put these non-conscious parts together and then end up with a mind. Like, you can't just put these non-conscious building blocks together in such a way that like magically it becomes like something to be those building blocks. Because a lot of panpsychists have that intuition. And, you know, Galen Strawson pushes that line pretty forcefully, but a lot of people seem to think that is the one and only reason that anyone would ever be a panpsychist. Like Philip Goff, who's like one of the most well-known defenders of panpsychism, doesn't even share that intuition. He doesn't think that's a good argument. And he's like, no, I think you could probably put things together in such a way that experience could come from non-experience. Yeah. So, I mean, I think people don't really know what the view is, and they also get confused about the motivation for the view. But yeah, those are two things that come to mind.
Have you spoken with Phil before?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple of times.
That man has very unique views about that I really enjoy.
I agree with him about a lot of things. Like I said, I'm not really rooting for anyone earlier, sure. But I guess he's probably closer than most people to like my general views. So I do like to see him out there defending his weird views.
Yeah, I like that he is in a place where he engages with people of multiple different sides. Like he debated William Lane Craig, but he also debated like Sean Carroll over something completely different. It's just very cool seeing that, you know, people have multiple facets in their mind that they can just kind of go to depending on who they're debating. But yeah, that's interesting, because when it comes to consciousness, how do you think researching it has kind of changed the way you experience your sort of own mind on a daily basis? Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it has. I mean, like, I remember being in like middle school science class and trying to figure out if colors were on objects or if they were just in my mind. And like, it turns out that's like a, you know, it's like an age-old philosophical question. Like this, it's more of like an epistemological question about like direct realism versus indirect realism. But like when you're looking at like a red ball, do you just have access to like your experiences of the red ball? Like, are you only in touch with like your own mental states, or are you actually like somehow connected to the external world where like the redness is on the ball and it's not just in your mind, you know? And I mean, apparently the direct realist view is the intuitive one where you think the redness is on the ball. But from like a young age, I thought, no, it's just, I only have access to like my mental representation of the ball. And this is a bad argument, but I remember what I was thinking. It was like, well, there are all these like colors and all these like, you know, this huge segments of the electromagnetic spectrum that I can't see. And it's like, so clearly my mind is like playing some kind of constructive role where it's like representing things to me. And there's a lot of stuff out there that is not being represented to me. And again, that's not a good argument, but that's kind of what I was thinking is like, well, it has to be sort of constructed, like my perception of the world is like partly constructed by my brain and my mind. I'm not just like, I heard the other view disparaged one time as immaculate perception, where you're just like, you're somehow, you just have this like pipeline to reality, like hooked up to your mind all the time. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if I'm a direct or indirect realist, but I do kind of lean towards indirect realism. It just makes more sense to me, even though apparently that's not the common sense view.
Dan, you must have been the kid at the sleepovers that was also like, dude, is my blue your blue? Is your green my green? Like that kind of thing?
I did, and I annoyed everybody. This is what I mean. I was like, no one cared about philosophical questions or knew what it was. I didn't know what it was. It was just like, do we know we're not in the Matrix? Like, do you experience the world the same way that I do? And like, everyone's just like, shut up. Please, please never speak to me again.
Yeah, and because being a philosopher, I think I asked Joe Schmidt this question too. It's like, how do you not experience, because you said you'd had after Christianity for a couple of weeks, but still nonetheless, how do you avoid experience kind of like existential dread with some of these deep topics and issues?
How do I avoid what?
Experiencing deep existential dread when it comes to some of these topics and issues, not necessarily consciousness, but even other things you can think deeply about, morality, ethics within animals and all these other things.
Yeah, I don't know, because I haven't figured that out, because I do often feel like I don't know anything. Like I feel like, you know, epistemically kind of nihilistic sometimes. And it just makes you want to like watch TV or something, because it's just like, what's the point? Like, I'm not going to figure anything out. It's just you're born and then you wonder and then you die having none of your questions answered. And it's like, I think that's true, but it doesn't really stop me from wondering, except for like short periods. Yeah, there's just nothing I can do about it. I just can't stop doing philosophy and like thinking about things. Like every time I try, it just naturally happens all over again. But yeah, I think there are like mysteries. There are things that we're just not going to be able to figure out, and you just have to embrace the uncertainty.
Yeah, because I guess it's also challenging not to over philosophize everything too.
Yeah, I mean, it's challenging socially because, like I said, you annoy everybody. But but what do you mean? It's hard not to over.
Well, yeah, I guess even socially too, because I imagine if you go to a party, I'm not saying you can't be social, but I mean, I've even struggled with this too. I'm not even a philosopher, because some conversations beg to be only surface level. But a lot of times you want it to go deeper like every time, but it's not safe to go deep every time. But someone that thinks deeply, like yourself, I imagine, wants to take it there a lot of the time. Like, are you pretty good at navigating those kind of conversations and just floating with the structure of surface level conversations versus wanting to go deep almost all the time with these conversations?
Yeah, no, I learned over time, like just that most people don't want to hear it and don't want to talk about it. So you just like, yeah, you just talk at the level that people want to talk at. And then every once in a while, there's someone who asks an interesting question, and then, you know, you have an in to like talk about it more. But yeah, I mean, I realize most people don't care about this kind of stuff, so I just don't bring it up. And it's only like when there's kind of, it's like you're a vampire, you have to be invited in. And then once you are, then you can, you know, you can start taking it deeper. But yeah, I mean, most people Like if someone walked up to you and started asking like really abstruse questions about econ or something, that would be annoying to me. Like, you know, so yeah, it's just, I mean, to me, philosophy feels different than that, but yeah, I've learned over time that, just don't bring it up. Like you can just kind of keep it surface level. And then sometimes the conversation goes somewhere else, but that's why I love going to like philosophy conferences and stuff, because it's just, there's none of that. Like you can just immediately start talking about real issues and everything. And, the last one I was at was for Paul Draper. It was kind of like all about his work. And we were at the bar afterwards, and which is always the best part, is just hanging out with the other conference attendees, like after the talks and everything. And the waitress was coming around, and she was just like, there's just like a huge table of like 30 people. And she's just like, man, she's like, you're all talking about different things, but every one of these conversations is like really interesting. And I was just like, what do you think about abortion? And then we were just talking to the waitress for like 10 minutes about her opinion about abortion. But yeah, that's why it's fun to hang out with like other philosophically minded people.
Props to that waitress for being open to talking about that. Because that's getting asked about that in front of people is like, ooh. Mm-hmm. Where was this conference at?
Indiana.
Was this at Purdue?
Mm-hmm.
Was Graham Oppy speaking?
Yeah, over Zoom.
Whoa, that's so interesting you mentioned that. I was out to coffee with a gentleman about a month ago, and he mentioned he was going to that same conference. But that's cool. Yeah, because how many conferences like that have you been to?
Maybe like 10, I want to say, over the past like 5 years. It started with like some friends were just like, oh, we should all go to the Capturing Christianity conference. And then all these people who I only knew from the internet, we like all went to the same place, and I think it was somewhere in Texas. And it was just like so much fun. We just kept, we did it like, you know, another half dozen times. And then, yeah, I think it's like usually at least once a year, like once or twice a year for the past like 5 years, just people who I know on the internet try to be like, okay, let's all go to this one. And then we usually get like five or six people at least who all go, and then we just hang out at the conference.
That's fun. How big was the Purdue conference, you think?
It was huge. It was a little too big. It was like the biggest one I've been to. And normally they're a little smaller, so it's easier to kind of like talk to everybody. You can talk to any speaker you want to, and everyone kind of goes to the same place. But this one, there were so many people there. It was like, there were like, you know, 10 different little groups like sectioning off and everything. But yeah, the Draper one, there were like, you know, well, I don't know if it was like 100 people. It felt like between 1 and 200 people. It might have been less than that, but that's what it felt like.
Wow. And outside of Christianity, what would you say was the, I guess, last major belief that you abandoned?
This is really recent, but I used to think the simulation hypothesis was just kind of a joke, or like, you know, a different like skeptical scenario, like a brain in a vat or something. And I still don't think it's true, but I think the odds are like, you know, between 25 and 35% maybe, which is like shockingly high to me, because intuitively you'd think it would be like infinitesimal. You think it would be like an extremely marginal, negligible probability. And then, yeah, I just started reading some stuff and it changed my mind. Like, I think there's like a pretty good chance that we're in a simulation. That's probably the biggest thing most recently that I've changed my mind about.
Okay, tell me what about it convinces you. Or not convinces you, but tells you that there's a chance.
Yeah, I mean, have you read David Chalmers' book, Reality Plus?
I have not.
I mean, that's basically it. Like, I read his book and I hated simulation stuff. Like, I hated when people talked about it. And I don't even know what led me to want to read his book, but I had like a long drive, so I just got the like audiobook and I was listening to it, and it was kind of freaking me out because I'm like, he's making a really good case that we're in a simulation. And then I bought like a physical copy of it and started reading it a little more carefully. And the thing is, it just comes down to like two premises. It's just a possibility premise, and if it can happen, then it will. Like, you know, is it possible for it to happen? That's the first thing you need to think about. And then, will it happen if it's possible for it to happen. And you can sort of talk about different ways you could block that. So like, first of all, is it possible for beings in a simulation to have like a subjective point of view? And the crucial issue there, I think, is substrate independence. So like, you know, one way of fleshing that out is it sufficient to mimic the causal dynamics of the brain and body? Or does it really matter that this is like biological material that I'm made of? You know, like, does it really matter that I'm like a biological organism? And if I were made of silicone, then like, I wouldn't be conscious at all. So, you know, I think it's plausible that the substrate doesn't really matter. Like, it doesn't matter if you're like a biological thing. What matters is like the organization. Like, if I were to slowly change out your brain with, you know, change out the carbon with silicon, if you just imagine that's possible, it's like, okay, what would happen if I were like gradually over time to switch out the carbon with something that's like artificial? Do you think that your consciousness would just disappear at some point? Or do you think at some point you would just have an artificial brain and you'd be like kind of half robot or something? And it's like, well, look, I don't know the answer to that question, but it doesn't seem obvious one way or the other. It seems like it could go either way. Like, you could, like, maybe the substrate really matters and maybe it doesn't. And if it doesn't matter, then it's possible for simulations to be conscious, I think. So that would make it possible for, you know, conscious sims to exist. And then the other premise is just, okay, say that it's possible for conscious sims to exist. Is there any reason that might not happen? You know, it makes it not feasible. So like, one idea people have is that there's this civilizational filter where an intelligent species is basically destined to destroy itself because it's going to create this technology, you know, like AI or nuclear weapons or whatever. And it'll end up like, you know, going extinct or like, you know, causing catastrophe after catastrophe. And it'll just never advance to the point where it would have the technology to create conscious sims. So like, that's one way you could block the second premise. Another way is just saying like, well, it's possible, and they, you know, some advanced species, like, they would be able to do it, but they would just have no interest in doing it. They would just choose not to do it for some reason. So like, there are a bunch of different possibilities like this, but none of them really seem all that plausible. Like, I don't really have that much confidence in any of those. So if you think, okay, just say 50-50 whether or not it's possible to create a conscious simulation, you know, so 50-50 to substrate independence. And then think, okay, it's like 50-50 whether or not any of these sim blockers actually work, you know, like the civilizational filter or saying there's like a lack of interest. Okay, 50-50. Well, then you just multiply 0.5 by 0.5. That leaves you with 0.25. So there's a 25% chance that like 99.9% of all conscious beings are in a simulation. So that leaves you with like a 25% chance that we're in a simulation, you know? Because, I mean, there, the last step is just, look, if 99.9% of conscious beings are in a simulation, then you are probably one of the simulated beings because we don't have any special evidence that we're not in a simulation. So, I mean, I can't really see what's wrong with that. So, I mean, to get the probability down, you would have to argue that you are very confident that substrate independence is false, that it's very important that you are a biological organism and that nothing that's not made of like carbon could be conscious. Or you have to argue that like necessarily an intelligent species is going to like blow itself up or something with nuclear weapons. And yeah, I'm just not really confident in any of that. So I end up thinking there's a decent chance we're in a simulation.
It's okay. That's interesting, because I always felt like simulation theory puts both theism and atheism in a very interesting spot. It isn't really wreck either. I mean, it kind of does, but at least pushes the question back further whether one or the other is true. But if simulation theory is true, it's like, okay, there's this sort of little g god thing happening here, or is there some kind of supreme god above the people in control of the simulation? Because I'm sure you're giving thought to the whole, like, if it's true, the scariest part about it's almost not just the fact that we're in one, but the controllers themselves could be literally anything out there above us, what that even means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that theism is kind of related. I think people like overstate how related these things are because they think that simulation hypothesis is just like, you know, theism for dorks or something. But the argument I just laid out is not like a quasi-religious argument at all. And like, you know, that's the reason people take it seriously. It's not like I'm sitting here being like, well, the fine-tuning argument obviously works, but I'm afraid to admit God exists, so I'm going to say we're in a simulation. Like, that's not the line of reasoning. But yeah, I don't think the simulator would be God in any sense, really. I mean, it would be like, a simulator would be, I guess, the creator and designer of the universe. You know, so in that sense, that's kind of godlike. But crucially, I don't think it has anything to do with like right and wrong or morality or like what we should do. And a lot of theists seem to think that's very important. And for me, the most important part is whether or not this being is worthy of our worship. And I think very obviously a simulator is like not worship worthy. So I think that's an important part of being God, is that you're worthy of worship. You know, maybe the only thing that's worthy of worship, and a simulator doesn't meet that. So I don't think it's God.
Yeah. Interesting, man. Where do you fall on the alien hypothesis? You think they exist?
I mean, yeah, the universe is just way too big. Like, I don't know if we're being visited by aliens. But,
I guess that's the better question, honestly. It's never if they exist, have they been here? That's what I should
Yeah, I have no idea if they've been here. I'm pretty confident they exist just because the universe is too big. Like, the odds of life emerging would have to be so absurdly low for us to be the only ones. It just doesn't seem plausible. But the question of like whether any, you know, intelligent species has like built spaceships and flown here and then done a bunch of weird stuff with humans, totally separate question. And, you know, I don't assign like a zero credence to that either. Like, I'm pretty interested in that. Like, I talked to Jimmy Akin for like 3 hours about this on my channel. And we're both kind of the same mind. We're like, look, we're kind of agnostic about this. Like, you know, maybe we've been visited, maybe we haven't. There's not really a knockdown case either way. Because there are these really popular objections to the idea that UFOs are like alien. And we took the 10 most, you know, popular objections and we kind of undercut them. Didn't really like knock them down, but just kind of like undercut them to the point where it's like, you can't really lean on this as the reason why there definitely have not been any alien visitations. But at the end of the day, neither of us are convinced that like we've been visited by aliens. It's just, it remains a possibility, and the arguments against it are just not that impressive, even though, you know, they're very popular.
So did you guys entertain the, not just aliens being from other planets, but possibly them being interplanetary or under the ocean?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, because it's not just that they're from another planet. Like, they could be, like some people say, oh, they're from another dimension, or they're like crypto-terrestrials, or they're, you know, it's like, there are different ways you can think of them as kind of alien without thinking of them as literally just from another planet, and then they flew here in a spaceship. And yeah, we kind of talked about that too, but obviously I'm more interested in just the more straightforward, like, alien stuff.
Yeah, because have you, I assume you've, because that conversation obviously means that you guys probably been keeping up with the whole hearings and all that stuff about UAPs and what's been going on mm-hmm. that. Does that at all sway you? Has any of that swayed you more towards the possibility even more?
Yeah, I mean, the ever-present worry is that this is some kind of, like, you know, MJ-12-style disinformation campaign. Like, for those who don't know, there were these documents released in the 80s that were, you know, the Majestic 12 documents, and they were pretty much fake. I mean, there was some real stuff in there, but it was like an intentional disinformation campaign. And, you know, the government does that sometimes. They specifically lie about aliens. And you always have to keep that in the back of your mind. So, you know, it could just be, I mean, like, obviously the most plausible response to like most of the UFO stuff is like, oh, this is just military technology that they don't want to tell us about. And there are reasons to doubt that in some cases. But that is always like the most plausible response, is like, okay, it's not aliens, it's just military stuff and it's top secret, and that's why they're not telling us what it is. But yeah, sometimes governments lie about UFO, UAP stuff because, well, for some like geopolitical reason. Like during the Cold War, we were trying to get the Soviets to possibly think that we had some kind of like treaty with aliens, so that way they wouldn't attack us. Like, it was like one other thing. So it's like, well, look, if you attack us, then we might have alien technology. Okay, so you might want to think twice. I mean, like, it was just one of the many things that we did during the Cold War to try to, like, you know, keep them from attacking us. But yeah, there are other reasons. Like, one time there was this, I think his name was Richard Doty. I think that's the guy who was lying, but there was some guy who picked up on, like, a like secret program, like with military technology, and he took it to the Air Force base that was like in his neighborhood or whatever. And he was like, "Hey, I think I found like alien activity." And then they were like, "You're right. You're absolutely 100% right. This is like alien activity. And don't tell anybody about it because there's about to be like an invasion or something. And we're trying to work that out. So don't tell anyone because we don't want to freak them out." Because they just didn't want their program exposed. And this guy figured out about it, just like this civilian guy. And then he was like, "I think it's aliens." And they were just like, "Yeah, you're right. It is aliens," because to like keep him like at an arm's length from it. And that guy had like a nervous breakdown because like the cover story they were giving him was like terrifying. So there are like numerous examples of like disinformation campaigns around this. So whenever there are like hearings, you know, it's just, it should always be in the back of your mind. Like, this might just be propaganda. Cause it's just proven they've done this before. But, you know, it could also be real. There's, you know, it might be different this time, but you'd never know. I don't put too much stock in it, but it's worth like getting into the specifics. And, you know, like Jimmy Akin has also done that. Like, he'll, whenever these hearings happen, he'll kind of sum up what happened for the audience. And like, you know, he's usually pretty skeptical about it, but yeah, I do think it's interesting though.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think there's, cause we hit on parapsychism, consciousness, aliens, a few other things. But do you think there's kind of other sort of, I guess, worldviews or metaphysical systems you think deserves more attention that doesn't just doesn't get enough attention? It's like parapsychology maybe?
Oh yeah. I was going to say Mormonism, but yeah, that's another good one.
Mormonism, explain. I like to hear that.
Yeah, I don't think Mormonism gets enough attention. I think that at the end of the day, it's not that different from other forms of Christianity. I mean, there are notable differences. Many of them I consider advantages. But yeah, I think that it's treated, I think they're treated kind of unfairly. Like, I think that there are like pretty clear psychological and sociological reasons that Christians react so strongly to Mormonism. And it doesn't really have to do with like, you know, the Trinity or whatever the ostensible reason is, where they think Mormonism is ridiculous because they don't accept the traditional view of the Trinity. Like, does that really make sense at all? Like, I don't think that's the real reason why Christians react so strongly to Mormons. But yeah, I do think Mormonism, it's an interesting worldview and it is very different from other forms of Christianity, but I think it's still recognizably a form of Christianity. Like, in the grand scheme, I don't know if it's that different, but if you want to talk about the differences, they do seem like, you know, strong differences that could change your credence. Like, you know, Mormons are finite theists, I think. Like, Philip Goff is a finite theist. Mormonism is like a lot more at home with panpsychism. Like, their first philosopher was a panpsychist, and a lot of their doctrines seem to, if not imply panpsychism, be like uniquely consistent with panpsychism. And yeah, they're not really universalist, but they're kind of like universalism light, but they have like a weird version of that where there's like a structure to the heavens and afterlife. Yeah, and they have like a non-standard view of the Trinity, which is like roughly social Trinitarianism. And like, I find all these things pretty interesting, and like, I mean, to my mind, they're advantages, not disadvantages, but yeah, I wish that Mormonism would get a little more play. Part of the problem is that Mormons have like a huge bias against philosophy because they think the church was corrupted by Greek philosophy. Like, there was the early church, and then came in all this like Greek Platonic thought, and like it kind of intermingled with Christian doctrine. And that's why you have all this like weird, bizarre stuff like classical theism. And so they're like very standoffish about philosophy. But I think, you know, some of them are not, and they realize like, okay, you can use philosophy in a way that doesn't like corrupt doctrine. And yeah, so I hope there are more of them that get involved in like analytic philosophy and defend their views. But But yeah, I've defended Mormons quite a bit. I like them. I think that they have a, you know, like I was just, one of those philosophy conferences I went to was in Provo at BYU. And it's like, I just like it there. I like the little society that they've created. Like they, I don't, it's hard to argue with the scoreboard, you know, like when you look at the kinds of families they have and the kinds of like, you know, cities they build, it's like, I would like more of this, please. Like, it's kind of why it bothers me when people attack them like so ruthlessly. It's like, this has good consequences. Like just on a purely pragmatic level, like why would you want to like stigmatize this? Like, shouldn't you be promoting this even if you don't think it's true? Because if you're a Christian, it's like kind of close. But like I said, I think there are just reasons that are like purely sociological, where like, because Mormonism is, you know, thanks to like South Park and thanks to a lot of things in their history, they're kind of viewed as like synonymous with like obviously fake religion, like made by a person, you know, naturalistically formed religion. If you kind of grant too much credence to Mormonism, then you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot a little bit as like a non-Mormon, you know, because you're just granting too much. You're saying like, well, yeah, I guess it's plausible. And for a lot of people, it's like, well, look, if you're admitting that Mormonism is on even roughly equal footing with Christianity, yeah, that helps Mormonism, but it's also a huge detriment to Christianity because Mormonism is synonymous with like obviously fake and fraudulent thing. So I think that's why Christians get like very protective about the label Christian and don't want to extend it to Mormons, even though they're very Christ-like and even though they belong to a church with Jesus Christ on the side of the building. But yeah, I think that people are, you know, I don't want to just whine and be like, oh, they're not fair to Mormons, but like they really aren't fair. Like people are very dismissive. Like they suddenly act like Reddit atheists when Mormonism comes up, and they think it can all be debunked with like one or two rhetorical questions that they heard on a subreddit or something and don't bother to understand the history or the theology. And yeah, like I said, I like the kinds of things that Mormons build, and I don't think that their theology is like ridiculous. I don't think that it's, you know, it's just, like Sam Harris called it, Christianity plus a bunch of weird and implausible things, which sounds plausible on the surface. But then you start thinking like, wait, do I think the Trinity is like a really non-weird and plausible thing? It's like, no, I don't think most atheists feel that way. So Mormons kind of change their view of the Trinity to like a more social Trinitarian model. It's like, from Sam Harris's perspective, is that a weird and implausible thing? Like, he prefers the standard traditional view of the Trinity? Like, I doubt it. So anyway, I just think that, I would love to see people debate Mormons more often, as long as the Mormons are not just like, you know, missionaries or something, but they're actually like more philosophically informed. Then yeah, I would love to see more of that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I never really thought of like, there's not many, I guess, Mormon apologists on the internet, it seems. I remember there was one video particularly, Frank Turek was at some college campus and a Mormon was debating him on, I forgot what it was particularly, but it was actually a pretty good back and forth to where you probably would have to say, oh, this is actually like, I understand why this is a challenging question that he's asking to Frank and why Frank's responding the way he is. And how there's actually a disconnect, not just because, I'm not saying this as a Protestant Christian saying that the Mormon worldview is absurd, but I'm just saying in terms of what he was asking, like, oh, okay, I can actually see this being, this is actually a fair battle here, this debate itself happening. And the way they do community too, in Provo particularly, I think is highly admirable as well. Like the way they associate with each other, take care of each other, take care of the non-Mormon population as a whole in terms of generosity, kindness, all these things, all these fruits of the spirit, if you will, I think is definitely something that I do commend from the Mormon worldview.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear you say that. Like, because some people just dismiss all that stuff as like, yeah, Mormons are nice. And it's like, well, you might view it as like the fruits of the Holy Spirit. That's another way of saying that. Because I think they are maybe a little nicer than the average person. But like, yeah, it's not just being nice. Like, it's like what you say. Like, there are genuine fruits of the religion that at least from a Christian perspective, seem to give it some credibility. Like, if you're a Christian who thinks Joseph Smith was interacting with like a demon or something, it's a religion founded by demons and someone who wanted to sleep with other people's wives, and that's all there is to it. It's kind of weird that it has the effects that it has. Like, it's a little surprising. Like, I would expect a religion founded by demons to be like way worse than what Mormonism has turned out to be, for the reasons that you say, you know?
Yeah, I think they also do a very good job of maintaining discipline. For example, the idea that you have to take this 2-year hiatus when you're 18, if you're a Mormon, and go somewhere and spread your faith at such a young age is extremely hard to do, let alone having to do it sometimes in different states, but otherwise other times in different countries. That would certainly put some Mormon hair on your chest for the long haul of how challenging, I guess, your spiritual life can and will be. So I think that's a very good, them doing that, I think, adds a lot to the later joy and generosity that Mormons have for themselves and conduct in the world and their spiritual lives.
Yeah. And if you listen to ex-Mormons, it is, I mean, like, it is some of the funniest stuff I've heard. Like, I can't really, I mean, I have ex-Mormons in my audience and I like them and I respect them, but I'm just talking about like ex-Mormon, like YouTubers. Okay. Like, it's like bizarre. Like, I can't think of one who's good. Like, I can't think of anyone who like, oh, well, they make some good points and like, they're really philosophically like aware of what's going on around them. And yeah, there's just nobody. Like, I remember watching like one of the most popular ex-Mormon channels. I'm just trying to figure out like what's going on with these people? Like, you know, why did they leave? And it usually comes down to like political things. Like, Mormons are like pretty conservative. They're not like LGBT affirming, like generally speaking. So like that causes some people to leave. And that's roughly 50% of it, if I had to guess. But like the story I heard was crazy. It was like this guy talking about like he has 30 minutes to explain why he's like not a Mormon. Like it's his wife's channel or his girlfriend's channel. And then she's like, okay, like my boyfriend or whatever is going to, it's like a guest video. He's going to, you know, tell his story about leaving Mormonism. And like a huge part of the story was him getting in trouble for playing video games after his bedtime. And then, it was a console that was given to him for Christmas. And he was arguing with his dad saying like, you can't take away this console. It was given to me by Santa Claus. And then his dad snaps and is just like, I am Santa Claus.
And that's why he left.
This was a huge part of the video. So like, it's not why he left, but I'm saying like he was given 20 or 30 minutes and like he was saying this so somberly, like, because to me that was hilarious. But like he's describing this story like he was describing like some horrible abuse or something. And it's just like I find this over and over again with like ex-Mormon, like why I left. They're talking about how terrible it is to be raised in this cult, and it's just like it's always stuff like that. It's like what are you talking about? Like what are you doing? Like it's kind of frustrating. I've read a lot of why I've left Mormonism posts and videos and stuff, and that one always just made me laugh, but I'm saying none of them are like very impressive. And it's just like, what do you even say to that? Like, if I'm explaining why I left Christianity, it's like, I think eternal conscious torment is incompatible with theism. I think that the problem of evolutionary animal suffering is insurmountable, you know, because of the kind degree and distribution of suffering in the natural world. And then you give ex-Mormons the floor and they're talking about how their dad took away their video game. And how like Mormons aren't affirming enough of trans people. Like literally, like it. So anyway, I just have not been impressed with like the online ex-Mormon community. But just speaking about like prominent ex-Mormon YouTubers and stuff, it's just not a lot going on there.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have to dig more into that because I've been more on this like ex-Jehovah's Witness kick of seeing their stories. And their stories are usually always something like, ooh. Mm-hmm. That's bad.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. I guess it runs much deeper there than it does in Mormonism, just because, I don't know, Jehovah's Witnesses, you can kind of visually see them being very closed off as just individuals, despite the fact that they set up camp and whatnot around street corners. But there is a level of like mystery there. They're like, what's actually going on in Mormonism, typically at a lot of times are very kind of open. Like if I went, I feel like if I went to a, I emailed an LDS church to interview them about stuff, and they were very cool about it. Like they're like, yeah, come on in. We'll talk to you. I talked to three of them at once, two missionaries and one, I guess, poor person that worked at the church, and they're super kind. And they answered everything. It didn't really seem like they're trying to hide that much, at least, but maybe I'm romanticizing the memory. But anyway, so if your belief, or sorry, if your worldview was to radically change again, what do you think would cause that? Would have to cause it, I guess.
Like my worldview, I guess, just, you know, arguments and experiences. Like, I don't know, like, what do you have in mind? Like, what?
Yeah, because sometimes I'm thinking, like, I'll talk to people about their worldview, whether it's agnosticism, atheism, whatever it is. And sometimes I think, yeah, I don't think, because a lot of times arguments don't really work anyway to kind of convince people some of the time. Because other times I'm thinking, well, I think something more experiential would have to happen, such as I've heard of people giving God sort of a second try because they just had a child, and seeing the child and seeing life come into existence made them think more about their place in the universe, whether or not they had their own sort of possibly supernatural father above them because seeing this kid. So I guess for you, would to sort of turn away from atheism or even potentially become agnostic or anything outside of that, would you say that would take an actual maybe very special experience, I guess, whether it was possibly supernatural or not? Does that make sense? I feel like I kind of rambled there.
Yeah. No, okay. I get you. Like,
cool.
Yeah, I think a religious experience would change my mind. I've talked about this a little bit on my channel. Like, I think, I don't remember what the title was. It was just like things that would change my mind about God's existence. And yeah, one of the things was having a religious experience, which really irritated a lot of Christians. And at first I didn't get why. I was like, well, hang on. First of all, I'm saying that my mind is changeable. Like, I'm saying that you could change my mind. But I realized what they didn't like was that I was sort of implying that it's like God's fault that I'm not a religious believer. Because if God would just, you know, do this, then I would believe. And then the thing that I'm talking about is a thing that happens to a lot of people. So it's just like, it's not like I'm asking for something crazy. I'm asking for something that happens to a lot of religious believers according to religious believers. And I'm like, okay, well, can that happen to me? And they're just like, they're very annoyed by that because it's like, oh, the ball's in God's court. You know, it's like, I don't mean to give the impression I'm just like sitting back with my arms crossed, like, okay, God, impress me. It's just like, no, I would like to be reached out to in the same way that other people get reached out to. And it's like, yeah, that would change my mind. And there is sort of one thing like that happened. Like you mentioned, you might ask about like paranormal or supernatural encounters. There was one like sort of quasi-religious experience that I had a few years ago that has never stopped bothering me. And it wasn't like directly of God or anything like that, but it was just one of those things where it's like the timing is just so improbable. And I don't know if I'm really ready to talk about it because it is kind of like personal, but it is also something that's like, it was very meaningful at the time and like, you know, caused me to like break down and everything. And it was just like, it wasn't like I asked for something to happen and then it happened. It was just something that I needed to happen, happened at the exact moment I needed it to happen. And it's just so, so improbable. But yeah, I don't know if I want to talk about it now, but because I'm not even sure if it would sound dumb if I talked about it. Like a lot of religious experiences, they don't translate well, you know, when you're like trying to explain them in language or like, you know, write it down. It just doesn't come across right. And like I said, I don't even know if it technically qualifies as a religious experience. It's just something that is very hard to explain. Not incompatible with naturalism or anything like that. It's just has more to do with the timing, you know, and like the nature of it. But sorry for being so vague about it. But
no,
yeah,
fine.
I mean,
yeah.
If something like that were to happen that was a little less ambiguous, then yeah, it would be pretty hard to ignore. The first one, I'm not ignoring it, but it seems maybe a little thin to like change my entire worldview over. But if there was something a little bit more, you know, directly related to God, I guess that would change my mind. But yeah, I mean, I think I am capable of changing my mind because of arguments. Like, I've done it many times before. Like, used to not believe in free will, now I do. You know, used to be agnostic about moral realism, now I'm a moral realist. Used to be a theist, then I was an atheist, now I'm an agnostic. Used to be a materialist, now I'm not. Like, I do change my mind as a consequence of arguments sometimes, so I think that could also do it. But a lot of the arguments for God are like either really weird or just really unconvincing. And but yeah, I think a religious experience would do it. I also mentioned how Christian aliens would change my mind. Like,
Christian aliens, that's an awesome thing. Okay, so that would, I assume that would have to change your mind. Yeah, because
how could you not change your mind? I mean,
that would be, oh my gosh, that's so cool that you said that, because that, it's so funny you say that, because aliens give so many Christians pause, because aliens suggest they have to be, it's usually from a Christian perspective, categorical of it being either a demonic experience or they just can't exist because that would, for whatever reason, contradict God from their from some people's purview. But the idea of them coming to Earth and saying, hey, yes, we also know Jesus, would be so groundbreaking as a sort of worldly sight. I just couldn't imagine that happening now.
I know. I mean, the thing is, you'd have to rule out them trying to like manipulate us somehow. But
sure,
if you could become convinced that like, no, Christianity just arose independently on another planet, it's just like, well, I mean, come on. Like, if like that's like the kind of thing that you would use for other areas of knowledge. Like, you know, people come to the same answers about chemistry on different continents, and, you know, same answers about physics and other things that are like objectively real. And it's like, yeah, if people on different planets get the same answer to like theological questions, that would be spectacular evidence. You know, like if completely causally isolated from Earth, Christianity arose on a different planet, that would be fantastic evidence for Christianity. So like, you know, if there, I have no idea why people think aliens are a problem for theism. Like, it just makes no sense to me. But
yeah,
yeah, there's literally no reason to think that they're all demons. And, you know, Jimmy Akin has made that case that like, you know, it's not that it's impossible that they're demons, but like, there's no reason to think that. And there's nothing wrong. Like, there's no incompatibility between theism and life arising on other planets. It's just like, I don't even know what the problem is supposed to be. But if they were Christians, that would be great evidence for Christianity. So that's like, yeah, that's a little out of left field, but that would change my mind as well. As well, you know, a religious experience would change my mind, and Christian aliens is like a weird one that I guess would change my mind too.
What if the aliens came and said Islam's true? What are you doing?
It's the same thing for Islam. I would have to
convert. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, again, you'd have to rule out like, okay, are they lying? Like, are they manipulating? But like, if you could find out to your satisfaction, like what the history of their planet was, and it turns out like, yeah, just Islam happened over there too. It's like, you know, it's like the same thing that I mentioned earlier. It's just, if people in different times and places claim to be studying something objectively real, and then they don't disagree, they come to the same conclusion, like, that's good evidence they're studying something that actually exists.
Yeah. And real quick, that experience you had, you mentioned just a few minutes ago, have you consulted someone else about that experience?
I told one person about it, other than my wife, but... Oh yeah, I had a daughter, and it did not convert me to theism. It was a very profound experience, and I love her more than I realized I could love anybody, but it's, yeah, it is kind of weird to me when people think, yeah, I guess God exists because of my baby. It's like, I don't know. It's, the whole process is like so biological. It's just, I don't know. I was not blown away by the miracle of birth myself, but anyway, what did you ask me?
I just asked if you had told someone about your experience. You said you mentioned it to someone outside your wife. I was just curious, yeah. I guess, what did that individual say about it?
I think she thought it was going in a different direction than it was going. But yeah, I mean, she was impressed by it. She was like, you know, she took it to be like evidence for theism, even though, and I remember telling her, I was like, yeah, I do think this is like a, you know, it's not like exactly a religious experience, but it is just very interesting, you know? And like, that's, I guess, part of the reason why I can't let the theism versus atheism thing go, is because like, left to my own devices, like just going through arguments and thinking about the evidence, I ended up being kind of an atheist. And then, you know, kind of softened on that due to like psychophysical harmony and a couple other arguments. And yeah, and then there was this experience, which is like always in the back of my mind. Like, if that was God reaching out, then like I just can't like close the door to theism, because it might have been that. So like, it, you know, it kind of keeps me a little more open-minded than I would otherwise be if I were just thinking about arguments.
Man, I'm praying for a Christian alien to show up, a second experience, or a Joe Schmidt conversion. Those would be world altering for you.
Those three things, that would be a huge problem. Yeah, Joe giving up on the problem of evil, Christian aliens, and another, I mean, like a more definitely unambiguously religious experience. Like those three things together, I would definitely be a Christian. I'd be in church the next day.
Cool, man. Well, I got one last question for you then, because we always ask every guest on our show this last question. One question you would ask God, knowing he'd answer right here, right now, what would you ask him?
I would ask him, what is the correct theodicy? As in, why do you permit the kind and degree and distribution of suffering on earth? The thing is, if I'm already confronted with God, then I know there must be some answer already. Like, if I just found out God existed, then it's like, well, I guess one of these must work out, but I would really like to know which one. But yeah, I guess I would ask about my biggest problem with theism, which is just, why do you permit this kind of suffering and the degree of suffering that you do? Yeah, I would like to know the answer to that, because there are a lot of really bad answers, and I would hate to like think I had to commit to one of those. So I would just want to know what the right answer is.
Yeah, because it would kind of suck if the answer he gave you was like not extraordinary. Like, what if it was just like an average answer? That maybe an average, something that you accepted as average, but it was also something you haven't heard before.
I guess that. I mean, be kind I, of obviously, I would accept it. Like, I would.
Yeah.
I guess that's the answer. But yeah, if he just said like free will or like soul building, then I'd be like, really? But like, I mean, okay, like, you know, you're God, so you're right and I'm wrong. But like, it's really like soul building is the whole thing. Like, I mean, I assume that real answer is like a combination of like 20 different theodicies or something. Like, I doubt there's any like one catch-all answer, but yeah, I mean, because to me, that's the only thing that makes sense is like, okay, look, free will can explain tiny, tiny bit of evil. Soul building can explain a tiny, tiny bit of evil. And like every theodicy, like just going down the line, like it can probably explain some non-zero amount of evil, but there's no one of them that like solves the whole thing, you know? Like, I mean, that would be even more than just finding out that God exists. Like, the thing that would be the most surprising, like the most surprising answer he could give would be a short answer, like where it's like, well, there's basically this one theodicy that kind of explains it all. Like, that would be shocking to me more than any other answer he could give.
Awesome. Well, Emerson, man, appreciate the time. Any last words, pieces of thoughts, advice, wisdom you want to leave with the audience?
No, not really. I guess you can find me on YouTube at Emerson Green. But thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Cool. Well, that's Emerson Green for your Worldviews. Take care.